We were also requested to start a local UFO group in Södertälje, affiliated with UFO Sweden, as this national organization was supported by the brothers. As a naive and idealistic teenager, I felt this was like entering Shangri-La, meeting a man who not only had observed flying saucers, but was in contact with the visitors and working with them. The meeting with Sten and Jan worked like a salvation experience and left me high for weeks. Kjell Johnson and I founded our local group UFO Södertälje with constant advice from Sten, who claimed telepathic information from the brothers. For about 2 years we worked with all the many and unusual projects initiated by the IGF group, like going into some forest, holding hands and waiting for a flying saucer to land. In the autumn of 1972 I had become increasingly critical of the many claims and activities of Sten Lindgren and his group. Years of research and investigation later made it clear that many of the observations and contact experiences that he referred to had mundane explanations. I never found any concrete evidence that Sten was in physical contact with an alien group. But there were a few UFO observations with group members that are puzzling and not explained. Still, I can to this day wonder whether he was, in spite of all misinterpretations and wild stories, really involved in some hidden activity. Here is an example. In the autumn of 1964, Sten Lindgren, together with his friend BJ, known to me, went by car to a mine called Skullsgruvan in Värmland, Sweden. The reason for this excursion was to find lapis lingua, sometimes called the psychic stone. The mine was closed and they didn't find any lapis lingua, but on their way home a cigar-shaped mothership and several small bell-shaped craft appear over the car. One of the small craft makes a landing close to the road and Sten and his friend are led aboard and are then taken to the mothership. Here they meet a group of 5 or 6 people, among them 2 women and a man dressed in a suit. The space people ask Sten if they are allowed to erase his memory of this visit. He believes he was somehow programmed on this occasion. Sten and BJ are then led back to the car and continue the trip to Stockholm. According to Sten, there were several hours missing in their journey. They came home very late. This is corroborated by BJ. But he has no memory of any UFO observation or contact. Sten was later put under hypnosis by an unknown physician and then became aware of what had happened during the missing hours. Book written by Sten Lindgren, 1997, Dialogue with a Cosmic Culture. Looking back today on my involvement with Sten Lindgren and his group, I feel privileged for the experience. It was an excellent lesson in what esotericists would call discrimination or development of the critical faculty. Sten Lindgren was, and is, a gentle soul, a mystic, idealist and a man of goodwill. Even if his physical contact claims were fantasies, his philosophy was a worthy mixture of contactee philosophy and esotericism. In 1972 he led a study circle in parapsychology which was actually a course in esotericism, with AO material from the books by theosophist Charles Leadbeater. Today I have no contact with Sten Lindgren, but he was a catalyst in my life, in his own special way a guide and mentor that put me on a quest that still continue. For this I will be ever grateful. Serious investigators of UFO and paranormal phenomena sometimes, after many years, enter the arduous journey of proceeding from mere documentation of phenomena to philosophy searching for the elusive truth. Expressed in a different way, researchers hope to find a new paradigm or working hypothesis to account for all unexplained phenomena, as the mainstream materialist, reductionist paradigm has become an intellectually untenable position. This journey proves a real challenge, as there is a veritable smorgasbord of alternative worldviews and philosophies. Here are a few examples of alternative paradigms advocated by ufologists and other authors: Alan Hayek and Gordon Creighton, anthroposophy, Jacques Vallée, hermeticism, Gerard Utzon, Benjamin Creme, Andrew Thomas, Nicholas Rerich, Charles Upton, René Guénon. Readers of this blog are aware of that I have for some years argued for the esoteric tradition as presented by A.O. Helena Blavatsky, Charles Leadbeater, Alice Bailey and Henry T. Lawrence as the best alternative paradigm or working hypothesis. simply because in my view these authors represent the most articulate, scholarly and intellectual efforts to formulate esotericism as a science of the multiverse. A worldview and profound philosophy that can be accepted as a working hypothesis by critical and scientifically minded scholars and researchers. Unfortunately, the ufologists who have discovered and used this paradigm in their research are a rare species indeed on this planet. Two of the most prominent are Desmond Leslie and Riley Crabb, director of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRF, 1959-1985. As an esotericist, Riley Crabb even made this project his motto as expressed in his first editorial in the journal Round Robin July, August 1959. Since coming to the mainland, my lectures have been concerned with the problem of relating flying saucer data and phenomena to the teachings of the mystery schools. I believe you will agree this is no easy task. If I have one goal in life, it is an uncompromising search for truth, whatever that might be, and wherever it may lead. In this blog entry, I wish to reintroduce a British gentleman, T. Brian Edmond, who was both a knowledgeable ufologist and an erudite esotericist. I have mentioned him briefly in earlier blog entries. In 1976, I studied theoretical philosophy at Stockholm University and was very much occupied with the problem whether it was in accordance with scientific thought and intellectual integrity to accept, as a working hypothesis, the reality of a multiverse in an esoteric sense. Although the information generally cannot be verified by traditional empirical data and research. Expressed in academic philosophical language, I tried to understand the fundamental ontological and epistemological issues in relation to esoteric philosophy. In common language, what is reality and how do we acquire knowledge of reality? Unexpected help with this problem came from a letter to the editor of Flying Saucer Review, February 1976. Volume 21, Number 5, titled Ammo Again. It was written by Mr. T. Brian Edmond, living in Chester, England. Here was a man who obviously was very well informed on both the UFO problem and esotericism, quoting authors such as John Keel, Mead Lane, Alice Bailey and Charles Leadbeater. On April 26, 1976, I wrote a letter to Mr. Edmond, expressing my appreciation of his views and that I also in my research was trying to blend the scientific and esoteric approach to this fascinating subject and was therefore searching for people to correspond with who are both, how shall I say, ufologists and esotericists. On May 1, 1976, I received a very friendly, extensive, handwritten reply saying, "Your letter came as quite a pleasant surprise, and we certainly appear to think along the same lines." Although I received only two extensive letters from Mr. Edmond, his ideas and theories had a seminal influence on my thinking and research. Using the method of my old mentor, Riley Crabb, in his journal Round Robin, I will give a summary of some of the points we discussed in Eclipse, quotes and comments form, with digitized excerpts from the letters of T. Brian Edmond. From FSR letter February 1976. This probably means that T. Brian Edmond was not a formal member of the Theosophical Society, and as he also quoted Alice Bailey, a more adequate term for his worldview is esotericist. What he had discovered was that their teaching is relevant to our subject. In the second letter to me, he detailed some interesting biographical data and history regarding his esoteric studies. Esotericism is of course hardly a respectable worldview even today, if you wish to be of the mainstream cultural and intellectual elite. But after both academic studies and many years of private reading of philosophy, I have reached the same conclusion as T. Brian Edmond. Esotericism is the only branch of philosophy worth studying. The esoteric tradition, the ancient wisdom, the knowledge of reality, the science of the multiverse or the philosopher's stone is the philosophy par excellence. This statement was a definite eye-opener to me. Finally, a tenable philosophical attitude to esotericism acceptable to a scientific and critical mind. Later I found this, esotericism as a working hypothesis view, clearly formulated many times by Alice Bailey and Henry T. Lawrence. from FSR letter February 1976. This is a correct observation. John Keel was an excellent reporter and Fortean investigator, but he was no esotericist, and his taxonomy of entities in the multiverse is very simplistic and reduced to elementals. This was one of the reasons that Riley Crabb regarded him as a metaphysical illiterate. But elementals are obviously sometimes reported as UFO entities. In my estimation, the Vagaro encounter of October 1965, that I investigated, was most probably elementals. This is a very interesting comment, that the advent of visitors from other planets was unforeseen even by the adepts or planetary guardians of Earth, and consequently not mentioned in esoteric literature. Like T. Brian Edmond, I had in vain searched in many esoteric tomes looking for information about interplanetary visitors in our time. In The Coming of the Guardians, Mead Lane concludes that none of the great occult orders has anything to say regarding UFO phenomena. It was not until a couple of years ago that I finally did find an answer to this question, by a renewed and detailed study of Alice Bailey's The Externalization of the Hierarchy. In this volume, the Tibetan adept D.K. actually confirms that the coming of interplanetary assistance was an unforeseen event even by the planetary guardians. But being an Oriental, he unfortunately presents this information in somewhat cryptic and symbolic language, although the meaning becomes obvious when comparing his many statements, which I have noted in earlier blog entries. Interplanetary visitors came in large numbers during the Second World War to assist the planetary guardians in a critical period for mankind. The implications of these quotes are obvious. April, May 1940, hovering today within the aura of our planet are certain great spiritual forces and entities, awaiting the opportunity to participate actively in the work of world redemption, re-adjustment and reconstruction. The waiting extra planetary forces. April 1943, certain great energies of extra-planetary significance who stand ready to intervene. T. Brian Edmond, being an old British gentleman, I was naturally interested in learning how he, after a lifetime of study and searching, estimated our existential situation on this planet. As he was a long-time student of the esoteric tradition, I was somewhat surprised by this honest reply. From an esoteric viewpoint, this estimation is basically correct. Life on this planet is full of pain and suffering. The Tibetan, in Alice Bailey's books, often refer to Earth as the Star of Suffering, this woeful planet, the unhappy little planet of suffering which we call Earth, this planet of suffering, sorrow, pain and struggle, etc. But the reason for this appears to have eluded T. Brian Edmond. The esoteric tradition makes it very clear that our planet is, in a penal colony, a sort of interplanetary Alcatraz. This means that evolution on Earth is exceedingly hard and much more difficult compared to other planets. T. Brian Edmond quotes the Tibetan in saying, "On no other planet in the solar system does the same degree of suffering and misery exist as on this globe." To which Edmond adds this comment, "Not a comforting philosophy, but I want the truth, not comfort." After the second letter from T. Brian Edmond, I heard no more. I wrote a couple of times in 1976, but as he was a very old man, I suspected he had died. His two very extensive letters were a great help to me during the 1970s, especially since I received a long list of recommended literature. To this day, I cherish the memory of my correspondent, friend and mentor. As I mentioned in a recent blog, my first mentor in the intriguing world of ufology was the Swedish UFO contactee Sten Lindgren. During the first years of the 1970s, I participated in many activities initiated by Sten, some of them based on his telepathic inspiration from the space people. But in the autumn of 1972, I had become increasingly skeptical of his many claims of contact. I had listened to so many fantastic stories, believing six impossible things before breakfast, that finally my naive idealism changed into a more inquiring attitude. In my diary, November 23, 1972, I wrote, "It feels good to be normal again. These 2 years have been like some kind of UFO hypnosis. It is obvious that UFOs are much more than one believes from the start. The issue of contactees should be investigated and documented. A seminal influence in the late autumn of 1972 was my meeting the Swedish couple Sture and Tore Jonsson, who told of their rather frightening close encounter experiences and their involvement in the very complicated contact case of Richard Hoglund. These and other cases I investigated slowly turned me into a more critical researcher instead of a naive New Age enthusiast. It was during this period that I discovered the books by John Keel. I found his writing fascinating and challenging. His field experience, intellectual curiosity, criticism of traditional ufology together with an iconoclastic and liberating humor impressed me deeply. When my friends and UFO colleagues Anders Lodgren och Kjell Jonsson and I founded AFU in March 1973, our ideological inspiration came from John Keel and Jacques Vallée. Today Doug Skinner runs an excellent website devoted to John Keel. I corresponded with John Keel in the 1970s and 80s and also had the good fortune of having him as a guest in my home when he visited Sweden in October 1976. We were a small group of ufologists who gathered in my small one-room apartment in Sundbyberg discussing all aspects of UFO and paranormal phenomena for a couple of days. I was especially interested in hearing of his experiences and theories regarding the Men in Black, MIB, phenomenon and the very physical UFO and contact cases. Keel was intrigued by this aspect and convinced there were aliens among us. "I'd really like to get one," was his comment. In my copy of Operation Trojan Horse he wrote, "For my good friend Håkan Blomqvist, The Secrets of the UFOs is on page 321. Last page in the book is 320. Typical John Keel Fortean humor." Referring to his first book, Jadoo, 1957, in Operation Trojan Horse Keel wrote, "Previous to all this I was a typical hard, boiled skeptic. I sneered at the occult. I had once published a book, Jadoo, which denigrated the mystical legends of the Orient. But this is not quite true. Although it is written in typical Keel fashion with a critical and humorous spirit, there are several experiences and phenomena in the book which he can't explain and truly puzzles the young adventurer. He hear the sound of and get a short glimpse of what could be the abominable snowman. A mystical llama give Keel a demonstration of levitation while other llamas move chairs by mental power and prove their ability of remote viewing by telling of a fire going on in a distant village. When Keel checked later, there had been a fire in the village. Instead of denigrating these claims," he writes, "there was no explanation for these things. I thought I knew all the tricks of the phony Western mediums, but this demonstration stymied me." Although a hard, boiled skeptic, Keel does not appear as the typical debunker in Jadoo, rather as the inquisitive romantic adventurer. And I love his humorous comments, like this one: "One llama told me the way to vanish into thin air is to make the mind a complete blank. If this is true, then I know several people who should have disappeared long ago." After a lifetime of travel, field investigation and study of UFO, Fortean and paranormal phenomena, Keel reached the conclusion shared by many researchers into these areas: we live in a multiverse inhabited by a variety of diverse intelligences. In his last book, The Eighth Tower, he wrote, "Today many scientific disciplines are moving in the same direction, not realizing they are mapping a very old country. In a few years, perhaps even in our own lifetime, all sciences will suddenly converge at a single point, and the mysteries of the superspectrum will unravel in our hands." p. 216. This is a strangely prophetic announcement that could have been written by anyone familiar with the esoteric tradition. This country has been mapped by esotericists like Helena Blavatsky, Charles Leadbeater, Geoffrey Hodgson, Alice Bailey, Henry T. Lawrence, E.O. Although John Keel often used the term elementals, has documented their materializations and understand the problem of encountering them, he never seems to have considered esotericism as a paradigm or working hypothesis to understand these phenomena. This becomes even more enigmatic as he wrote in the final chapter of Operation Trojan Horse, "My skepticism has melted away, and I have turned from science to philosophy in my search for the elusive truth." Obviously, he never discovered esoteric philosophy. John Keel's lack of knowledge of the esoteric tradition was one of the reasons why another of my guides and mentors, Riley Crabb of Borderland Sciences Research Associates, never liked his writings. While I tried to defend Keel and present his views and investigations as opening new vistas and giving further evidence of a multiverse, Riley Crabb could never see it this way. In a letter to me March 23, 1980, he wrote, "He, John Keel, is a wilderness crying for a voice, and I've told him so. His writings, like those of Jacques Vallée, leave one hopeless." Yes, D.K. Bailey, H.B., does warn about the trickiness of Diva and elemental contacts, but he places them understandably in the overall picture of evolution we get from the Mahatmas of the Himalayas. There is no such inspirational lift from Keel and Vallée, and there can't be because the two men aren't even metaphysical kindergartners. They are metaphysical illiterates. Personally, I found a lot of inspirational lift from John Keel, although neither Keel nor Vallée could be regarded as esotericists. There is a massive data and conclusions in their books pointing to an interpretation clearly in line with the esoteric tradition. Like this quote from Keel's last book, The Eighth Tower, 1975, "Today, scores of scientists working in widely separated, unrelated disciplines are crossing the threshold into the world of ancient science. We call it progress, but Merlin will have the last laugh. Science is inching into magic." To me, John Keel and his books opened up a new world with his knowledge, humor and suggestive language. When you read Strange Creatures from Time and Space and are confronted with all the weird and frightening creature encounters, the author gives this final encouraging prophecy. "Someone within 200 miles of your home, no matter where you live on this planet, has had a direct personal confrontation with an unbelievable. Next week, next month, or next year, you may be driving along a deserted country road late at night, and as you round a bend you will suddenly see." H.P. Lovecraft would have loved that sentence. To keep the chronology of guides and mentors in my life, the relevant name here should have been Jacques Vallée. His writings and ideas have greatly influenced me personally in my research, and he was also an important inspiration in the founding of AFU in 1973. But as I have presented Vallée and his theories many times before, I refer readers to these blog entries. When reviewing the guides and mentors in my life, I find it difficult to arrange them in some sort of order of importance. They have all meant much to me during different time periods. Still, there is one individual that stand out as unparalleled and transcendent – the Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lorentzi. Henry T. Lorentzi, Henrik von Zeipel, 1882-1971, was an exceptional intellectual who studied philosophy at Uppsala University. His teachers were the famous Swedish philosophers Axel Hagerström and Karl Hedvall. For most of his life, Lorentzi also studied the basic tomes of the esoteric tradition, especially Helena P. Blavatsky, Charles Leadbeater and Alice Bailey. He wrote several books presenting the ancient wisdom with a modern scientific terminology, most of which can be found in English translations at the official website of the Henry T. Lorentzi Publishing Foundation. As an academic philosopher, Lorentzi especially addressed the basic scientific, ontological and epistemological issues and problems confronting students of esotericism. He often pointed out that the only scientifically and intellectually tenable attitude to the esoteric worldview is to regard it as a working hypothesis. To scientists without experience of other worlds than a physical, hylozoic scan, of course, be only a working hypothesis, the way of man, p. 39, online version. To the esotericist, the Lorentzi writings represent an invaluable treasure trove of data, a presentation of the ancient wisdom in a completely new way that can appeal to academics and non-conformist scholars. His criticism of other authors and writing style can be a stumbling block for the more emotional New Age mystics, but his books are not for the general public. Lorentzi is addressing the intellectual and cultural elite. His comments on science, philosophy, religion and cultural issues reveal a profound and penetrating knowledge. We also get to understand that his works have been inspired by one of the adepts of the inner government. "The knowledge of reality is not my work," Even though I was the instrument holding the pen that wrote it, and was made to rewrite every page until the content was approved as being correctly perceived. Knowledge of life. 4. There was an esotericist of rare capability. Lawrence fits the description. Swedish edition of the Philosopher's Stone. In the biographical chapters, Lawrence gives a short summary of what information is new and unique in his presentation of esotericism. Philosopher's Stone contains four revolutionary new teachings that were never given out even in the esoteric knowledge orders. The first one is the solution of the mystery of Trinity, the three equivalent aspects of existence, the basic idea of the absolute knowledge system, the foundation of the philosophy and science of the future. Matter, energy, consciousness, HB. The second one is the assertion that matter, the atoms, is the carrier of consciousness, that the meaning of existence is consciousness development, that this consists in the monad's continuous self, activation of consciousness in ever higher kinds of molecules and atoms, that these molecular and atomic kinds indicate the limits of the different kinds of consciousness, that not having this understanding the self, or monad, will drown in the ocean of consciousness there is between worlds 48 and 46, as Raja Yogis do. The third one is the objective criteria of the different stages of development indicated. The fourth one is the formulation of their laws of life, particularly emphasizing those which are essential to our times as introducing the Aquarian epoch, the epoch of law. Knowledge of Life 4.17, online version. I have written many articles and blog entries about Lawrence and his books, also with some critical remarks. As a ufologist, I have naturally been trying to gain a deeper understanding of UFOs and life on other planets from an esoteric viewpoint. There is no reference to UFOs in his books, but in a letter to a friend who asked his opinion, Lawrence writes, "Regarding the sources, I have no knowledge and I have never taken an interest in any type of phenomena. Actually, the idea itself is not preposterous. The inhabitants of Venus have, in addition to an etheric envelope, a dense aggregate envelope confusingly similar to an organism. They are far ahead of us in consciousness development and have solved their physical problems. They know all about us, so the visits could be a way to give humans something to ponder on." Letter, October 12, 1965. This is an interesting assertion that I have never found mentioned in the books by Alice Bailey or other esoteric writings. The esoteric tradition is on the side of mainstream astronomy in the opinion that no higher organic life is possible on our neighboring planets. Esotericists assert that highly developed civilizations exist on the other planets in our solar system, but at the next multiverse level, the etheric, normally invisible to our eyes. According to Lawrence, the people of our neighboring planets do have dense physical bodies consisting of atoms and molecules held together electromagnetically. This means they can be formed and dissolved instantly if the individual so chose. Interestingly, this is exactly what many of the first generation contactees reported to have witnessed, A.O. Howard Menger. But would they be normally visible or invisible to us on their own planets? According to Menger, they would be invisible. Unfortunately, Lawrence never gave an answer to this riddle. An American contactee with whom I have been corresponding for several years told me of his first experience of this phenomenon. Before I had my first visits, I was a total unbelieving skeptic. And I said to them at one point, "Give me proof, personally, and I need never ask that again, that's for sure. When you get proof, my friend, you will feel like the world as you knew it has ended." I remember the first time there was about five space people in 20, name withheld, house talking with her as I quietly watched, and then suddenly one of the men turned, looked directly at me, smiled gently, and then very slowly turned to the kitchen room wall and walked right through the wall. I watched this very closely as he then came back in. Let me tell you, those kind of incidents have a very deep and troubling effect on our minds because we cannot comprehend it. Mail conversation February 25, 26, 2012. We find the same type of materialization phenomena often mentioned in the theosophical literature, but then performed by the adepts or the planetary guardians. There is a charming episode described in Charles Leadbeater's biography How Theosophy Came to Me, It was in Madame Blavatsky's room in that hotel that I first saw one of the members of the Brotherhood. While sitting on the floor at her feet, sorting out some papers for her, I was startled to see standing between us a man who had certainly not entered by the door, which was straight before me the whole time, and had not opened.